The trip is beset with hardships small and large. At a place where they bed down for the night, they are pounced upon by every kind of mosquitoes, big as frogs, which bit them so that their faces swelled up. Never had they spent nights as bad as these. Once aboard ship, they face a storm like the one in the Book of Jonah, from which Agnon has taken the title. You cast me into the depths, into the heart of seas.
Welcome to Season 2 of The Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. Today we'll be reading In the Heart of Seas by Shai Agnon. This season of the podcast is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman. The text of the story that we've sent you is part of the Toby Press Agnon Library and has been made available to our subscribers, courtesy of the publisher.
Foremost among the stories the Jews tell, and will keep telling in the centuries to come, are those of Shmuel Yosef, or Shai Agnon, the most prominent modern Hebrew and Israeli writer, and the first to be awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1966. These podcasts can offer only a small fraction of what needs to be said about these stories, and I am especially conscious of this today in speaking about an author famous for fusing several distinct styles and levels of speech into a single work of fiction. In this, he follows his Hebrew-Yiddish predecessor, Mendel Amoichosvorim, whom we read in the first series, and who said that he himself wrote on four levels, signified by the acronym Pardes, which refers to the approaches that scholars use in Torah study. Pardes, there is Pshat, the straight or the literal, plain denotation of the text, Remez, the allegoric or symbolic connotation, Drash, the midrashic or metaphorical meaning, and Sod, secret or esoteric, mystical sense. This does not mean that one has to puzzle out all the four levels of meaning, as incidentally, I was taught to do when studying the allegorical meanings of Edmund Spenser's 16th century epic poem, The Fairy Queen. But it does mean that Mendele and Agnon found it natural to write in the multi-layered way they had learned to read, and that they intended their modern works to serve as extensions of traditional models in their compression, intricacy, and complexity, and also in their national significance. We keep this literary standard in mind as we approach today's work, In the Heart of Seas, in Hebrew Bilvav Yamim, published in pre-state Palestine in 1932, here in the translation by I.M. Lask. This is a short story, a very long one though, really a novella, that follows a group of Jews, 10 men and 7 women, who leave Buchach, Agnon's birthplace in Ukraine, to settle in the land of Israel. Although he gives us no date for when this might have happened, the Hebrew literary scholar Shmuel Verses, on the basis of certain details in the story, situates the fictional journey a century earlier, around 1835. The travels of this group, whom Agnon calls the Nilvavim, the people of good heart, take the actual route the Jewish travelers in those years did take and include many of the hardships that they would have endured over land and sea. At the literal level, then, we read of the Aliyah to the land of Israel of a group of pious Galician Jews in the 1830s. But rather than casting this as a quasi-historical work, Agnon integrates a great deal of early legendary material to compose a national fable. If you wish, you can track the travelers on a map across Europe to Turkey and across the Mediterranean. Or you can follow the ups and downs of their psychological progress. Or you can pick out the textual references through which the author and travelers experienced their route. Or you can just suspend your disbelief and appreciate the adventure. In the story Nerves, which we read earlier in this series, Yosef Chaim Brenner tried to capture the harsh reality of the 1910s when both he and Agnon first arrived in Palestine. Agnon, writing this novella 2 decades later, is after a truth about that resettlement that cannot be conveyed through realism alone. The individuals in the group are a cross-section of the Jews of their time. Among the plainest are Rabbi Pesach and his wife, who hope that the land will cure their infertility. Others are drawn by profound religious obligation. Milka, the coral seller, had entered into a second marriage on condition that her husband go up to the land of Israel with her, and had received a divorce from him because he would not go. Correspondingly, Reb Yosef Meir had divorced his wife on the same grounds, though her father offered him double his dowry if he were to stay in the marriage. He says, "I have already contracted with another bride, and I cannot shame her." Their vow to ascend to the promised land takes precedence over their marriage vow. Agnon captures the complexities of Zionism through the mixture of the practical and the sublime in the individual traveler's motivations. Agnon's pre-modern style should not blind us to the psychological insights of the story he tells. For example, inspired as the group is by the ideal of Zion, its members are also prey to every kind of misgiving. Satan warns Reb Alter that ants have gotten into the food that they have stored for the voyage. "Well then," replies Reb Alter, "we will have to learn from the ants to make our own careful preparations." Satan asks Reb Moshe whether it isn't his responsibility to stay home with his community. Reb Moshe points out that when he was selling his house, Satan told him to raise the price because he was going to the land of Israel. So it seems that Satan can alternately cultivate the rabbi's greed or prey on his conscience, changing arguments in order to thwart his decision-making. Anyone who has ever contemplated moving to Israel will recognize Satan's wiles in trying to talk them out of it. Additional qualms and questions arise at every new juncture and continue, actually, even after the group had reached Jerusalem, when they are told, "All trouble is hard to bear, but hardest of all is the trouble of making a living." This fictional work certainly does not make Aliyah seem any easier than it is. Well, some of the characters embody different levels of the story. Among the 10 men from Buchach is Reb Shmuel Yosef, the son of Reb Sholem Mordechai Halevi, a man who knows and tells inspiring legends about the land of Israel. Now, this is none other than our author, born Shmuel Yosef Tchatchkis in 1888 in Buchach, son of Sholem Mordechai Halevi, and the very storyteller whose tales of the land of Israel will entertain the travelers and us readers. How can the author have been among the voyagers a century earlier? And what is he doing in this book? Shmuel Yosef had actually moved from Buchach to Palestine in 1908. That same year, he had adopted the pen name Agnon when he published his first Hebrew story, Agunot. 5 years later, he returned to Europe, and then in 1924, resettled permanently in Jerusalem. In 1929, Arab mobs destroyed his home in the Talpiot section of Jerusalem, and that same year, he made his last visit back to Buchach. He wrote this work in 1932, as Hitler was coming to power in Germany, touching off a large-scale Jewish emigration to Palestine. Agnon thought of himself and his writing as part of evolving Jewish history, and here he writes himself back into this earlier Aliyah to incorporate his storytelling role in the national movement. Students of Talmud understand the concept, "there is no earlier or later in the Torah," to mean that the Jewish sources should be taken holistically, as if rabbis over the millennia were together engaged in the same national project. Well, Agnon interweaves history with legend, personal with national strands, thereby making all Aliyah contemporaneous. The modern Zionist movement includes within itself all the actual and fabulous elements that inspired it. If Agnon's presence among the travelers represents the cultural heritage of Zionism, a second character who opens the story represents the sod, the esoteric, the higher level of the text. This is how the story begins. Just before the first of the Hasidim went up to the land of Israel, a certain man named Hanania found his way into their house of study. His clothes were torn, rags were wound around his legs, and he wore no boots on his feet. His hair and beard were covered with the dust of the roads, and all his worldly goods were tied up in a little bundle, which he carried with him in his kerchief. Hanania, whose name means favored by God, is the dust-worn image of the wandering Jew, the potential Messiah with his feet in rags, while that kerchief or wrap, the mitpachat, holding his personal belongings, is Agnon's symbol for grace. When this semi-mythic figure joins the travelers, he undertakes to repair their books and to polish their vessels. They ask, "Are you a coppersmith?" And he replies that he is neither a coppersmith nor a bookbinder, but when I see a defective vessel, I feel pity for it and say, "This vessel seeks a completion." Then the Holy One, blessed be He, says to me, "Do this or do that," and I do it. His companions recognize that he is a simple man whose every word teaches a virtue. Wherever such a man may wander, God will be with him. He represents the perfection to which they can only aspire. Shmuel Yosef enhances the journey through his stories. Hanania reconnects it to its divine inspiration. We note, however, that Hanania is not the leader of the group. Rather, he joins them once they have decided to undertake the voyage. This is not a modern Moses spearheading the Jews out of Egypt, or even one of the early Hasidic masters who actually led their followers to Palestine. In Agnon's version of ascent to the land of Israel, it is when the people show the initiative that the grace of God may accompany him, not the other way around. It is also significant that when they board the ship for the final passage to Jaffa, Hanania is not with them. As we are later told, he stays behind in Europe to attend to unfinished business. He has learned that the leader of a band of robbers, a good Jew who had been drawn into criminal company, had sacrificed himself to protect his fellow outlaws, and that before being executed, he had mourned his wife, who would be left an aguna. As we know in Jewish law, a married woman whose husband has disappeared without giving her a divorce or without proof of death cannot remarry. This was an all too frequent calamity in the dangerous conditions of European Jews, and metaphysically, it represented the separation of Jews from their homeland or from the Almighty. From the word aguna, this symbol of tragic incompletion, Agnon derived his pen name. Hanania feels that before he sets off for the land of Israel, he must deliver to the woman the necessary proof that will release her from remaining an aguna. If he cannot rescue the Jew who was forced into a life of crime, he feels responsible for setting the man's family free so that the widow and children can perhaps eventually find their redemption. Now, the story of a robber band is the kind of adventure tale, a Robin Hood story, that was everywhere popular in those days. But in our version, rescue means releasing the Jews from Europe in a way that lets them overcome their fatal estrangement from both their origins and their destination. Though he is supernatural in part, Hanania still cannot be in two places at once, so that when the passengers set sail, he's not among them. And when they realize it, they are bereft. They worry for his fate, and they feel guilty for having abandoned him. Awareness of his absence makes the ship feel unsafe. The darkness grew thicker and thicker. Rats and mice were scurrying around in the lower parts of the ship and gnawing at utensils and foodstuffs. At midnight, they sing and pray to him who dwells in Zion, and from the sea comes a response. Here I quote, "Is it possible for water, which has neither utterance nor speech, to praise the Holy One, blessed be He? But these sounds are the voices of the boys and girls who once flung themselves into the sea. After the wicked Titus destroyed Jerusalem, he brought 3,000 ships and filled them with boys and girls. When they set out to sea, they said to one another, "Was it not enough for us to have angered the Holy One, blessed be He, in His house? And are we to be required to anger Him in the land of Edom?" Thereupon they all leaped into the sea together. What did the Holy One, blessed be He, do? He took them in His right hand and brought them to a great island planted with all manner of fine trees. And for the next several pages, Agnon spins out his extended version of this haunting legend about the children who chose to drown themselves rather than be taken into Roman slavery, and who then became the eternal guardians of travelers to Jerusalem. Ships sail past to the land of Israel. They ride the waves protectively to sing, "I will bring them back from the depths of the sea." These legends assure our travelers that they are safeguarded both by the Almighty above and by the trail of martyrdom that continues to inspire, to keep afloat, all who follow in its path. But let's not turn this book into a sacred text. Famous for undercutting the pious atmosphere that he himself creates, Agnon writes, "Indeed, we have heard a tale from such as tell only the truth of how they were sailing to the land of Israel on the great sea and heard a voice so sweet they wished to leap into the sea and follow that voice. But the sailors tied them up with their belts until the ship had sailed the distance away from that voice." You think we Jews are the only ones with weird legends about allurement? Agnon appropriates the story from Homer's Odyssey of the sailors who have themselves tied to the mast of their ship to avoid falling prey to the sirens, to remind us that if those, quote, who tell only the truth, that is, the Greeks, tell such stories and people call them classics, then myth offers a deeper level of truth. The trip is beset with hardships small and large. At a place where they bed down for the night, they are pounced upon by every kind of mosquitoes, big as frogs, which bit them so that their faces swelled up. Never had they spent nights as bad as these. Once aboard ship, they face a storm like the one in the book of Jonah, from which Agnon has taken the title. From the belly of the fish, Jonah cries out to God, "You cast me into the depths, into the heart of seas. The floods engulfed me. All your breakers and billows swept over me, and I thought I was driven away out of your sight. Would I ever gaze again upon your holy temple?" No great undertaking has ever been simple, but those crossing the seas to the land of Israel are part of a cosmic adventure. Yet however grueling it was to reach Israel when Agnon wrote this, he could not have imagined the depths to which European Jews would soon be condemned. This story was to become more relevant, more contemporary, with each passing year. Well, after the storm at sea subsides, the worst is yet to come. After 3 weeks of travel, the sailors catch sight of the coast of the land of Israel, only to discover that they are back in Istanbul, where they set out. Some critics suggest that in this way, Agnon was recording his own return to Europe from the land of Israel and his need to start out a second time, knowing the difficulties that lay ahead. And in the story, once they reach Jerusalem, other dangers and challenges await them. Pessel, one of the women, dies from the kick of a mule. Labush the butcher decides to return to Buchach. What he sought, he did not find, while what he found did not satisfy him. The group is never wholly abandoned nor wholly redeemed. At one point, where they are at sea, they see in the distance something that looks like a man floating on a magic carpet, except that the carpet is a kerchief. And sure enough, when they reach Jerusalem, Hanania has arrived there before them, transported by the very kerchief in which he had originally carried his worldly goods. Our divine emissary is one who sanctifies the ordinary. When they celebrate their arrival and their reunion, he refuses to sit at the head of the table, saying, "When the Messiah comes, He can invite me higher up if he wants me. As the higher spirit accompanying them, he insists that he does not take precedence over those who so laboriously come by land and sea. Indeed, this fable is curiously down to earth in what some readers may consider an anticlimax. It ends with most of these pilgrims dying in old age, buried on the Mount of Olives. Hananiah, too, dies after many long years, and many legends are spun about him. With this kerchief that brought him to the land, they cover his eyes when he finally passes away. Agnon wrote this at the most critical period in the history of Zionism, in the 1930s, when a tiny percentage of the Jewish people was securing the homeland for those who would survive to reach it. In a psychological, historical reenactment that is both the quintessence of Zionism and a deliberate challenge to the Zionism of his time, he takes on Herzl's famous epigram, "Wenn ihr wollt, ist es kein Märchen. If you will it, it is no legend." Fair enough, agrees Agnon. There must be practical Zionism, the pioneers who get the job done. It's not just a fairy tale. But the Jewish people cannot and dare not return to Zion without the legends. It can't be done without the storyteller on board, and it is not being done without God's blessing. Let's not try to simplify a historical process as complicated as ours, as that of the Jewish people, or forget those generations that kept the vision and the reality alive. That is why Agnon writes this book of Hananiah as a belated addition to the canon and concludes it with this address to the reader. Some will read my book as a man reads legends, while others will read it and derive benefit for themselves. With regard to the former, I quote from Proverbs, "A good word gladdens the heart. A good word cheers the soul and delivers from care." To the latter, I quote from Psalms, "But those who look to the Lord, they shall inherit the land." Readers have mined every sentence of Agnon for its meanings. When we ourselves tell the story of how the Jews returned to the promised land, we may rightly find ourselves quoting from the book of Proverbs and from the Psalms, and thereby also from In the Heart of Seas. That's it for today. Next time, a story that was written pretty much the same time as this one by Isaac Babel, the story Argamak. And until then, happy reading.